Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Michael Vann, but you can call me Mike. Today we'll be talking with Michitake Aso, an associate professor of history at SUNY Albany and author of Rubber and the Making of Vietnam, an Ecological History, 1897 to 1975. The book is part of the University of North Carolina Press's Flows, Migrations, and Exchanges series, devoted to, quote, new works of environmental history that explore the cross-border movements of organisms and materials that have shaped the modern world, as well as the varied human attempts to understand, regulate, and manage these movements. Rubber and the Making of Vietnam draws on Dr. Aso's research in Vietnamese, French, and English language sources from archives in Vietnam, France, the United States of America, Cambodia, Singapore, and Switzerland, as well as an impressive list of secondary sources. Just in terms of research, the book is quite an achievement, but it also offers a unique way of looking at 20th century Vietnamese history. Rubber and the Making of Vietnam also won the Henry A. Wallace Award from the Agricultural History Society. Congratulations. So, Mitch, welcome to New Books in History.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. It's a real pleasure to talk to you, and this is just a fantastic book and really a great achievement in research. So just to start off, find out a little bit about you. Please tell us how you came to be a historian of Vietnam, and not just a historian of Vietnam, but of Vietnamese environmental history. How did you come to be an environmental historian?
Well, probably the environmental part of that equation came first. I was an environmental engineering major at UC Berkeley as an undergrad, with an interest in history. And in my junior year, I think it was many years ago now, I took a course with a historian named Carolyn Merchant, who is a well-known environmental historian. And I just found the topic fascinating. I really, really enjoyed the class. I was an environmental engineer because of concerns about environmental issues and including climate change. And it struck me after a couple of years in the engineering section of that portion of that actually one of the most pressing things to do was to convince people that there were real problems and to tell their histories, these environmental issues. Now, I think that people have been doing excellent work on telling and getting the word out. But remember, this was the 1990s. So I'd say the national awareness of some issues like climate change was not as striking. And at the same time that I was doing environmental engineering, I was also taking Japanese history courses, which I was really enjoying. And then I would say what finally pulled me over to the dark side of history was the experience of teaching English in Vietnam for 2 years, right after I graduated from college. And I did that with volunteers in Asia. And that experience convinced me that Vietnam is a fascinating place. I kind of knew something about Vietnam. I was interested in Asia, but I had never had a course in Vietnamese history. And I was a self-taught Vietnamese language speaker before going there. So was really a kind of big discovery for me about the details and the language and the culture there. So after I finished that teaching experience, I thought of applying to graduate school. Now, of course, I wasn't a very convincing candidate, perhaps, for Vietnamese history. So I hadn't majored in history as an undergraduate. But I was lucky enough to get into University of Wisconsin's History of Science and Medicine program. And it turns out, on hindsight, that was probably the perfect place for me. I was working with an environmental historian and historian of medicine and science, Greg Mittman, who is now also doing some work on rubber. Also, I was working with Warwick Anderson, who's a historian of medicine, who wrote a pioneering book on the history of colonial medicine in the Philippines, and working with Richard Keller, who's a historian of France and its colonies, who's written on environmental and medical history. So coming out of that experience, I really got this idea of looking at environment and medicine and working on Vietnam. And of course, Wisconsin is also a good place to do Southeast Asian history. So I was able to work with Al McCoy and some other folks doing work on Southeast Asian history. And they were very open and very supportive of my efforts in environmental history.
Yeah, that's great. You could make those two programs within the university come together with the Southeast Asian studies, where they're so strong with Al McCoy, and also with the environmental component. And that's also fascinating that you start with the environmental engineering base and then come to history. I think a number of us historians who do environmental issues started as historians and tried to learn the science and so forth on the fly. That's great. So I'm curious as to how you define environmental history. And I noticed that the book in the title declares itself to be an ecological history. Is there a difference between the two? Does the terminology matter? Is there a distinction here? Or
yeah. So I will start, I guess, by talking with environmental history and about environmental history, and then explain why I decided to choose, in the end, ecological history as the subtitle. So maybe, you know, for some of the listeners who aren't as familiar with environmental history, they may think that rubber seems like an odd choice. It's, you know, rubber production and plantations are very much seen as a human endeavor. And you know, really, the histories of rubber in Southeast Asia have been written for decades, treating plantations as human projects and, you know, analyze economics of rubber, the labor relations or gender or anti-colonialism, all really human endeavors. There's also been some work on rubber that's looked at consumption. And so I think here of Stephen Harp's work on consumption of rubber in France, Marketing Michelin, a great book. But I wanted to build my book around to take into account both humans and non-human nature, including the rubber tree, which as you know, it grows wild in the Amazon, so very much a part of non-human nature there. But also the soils, the animals, the plasmodia that surround this tree, and the major example of that kind of work for rubber, when I started graduate school, is Warren Dean wrote a book called Brazil and the Struggle of Rubber. And he called it an environmental history. And, you know, he was one of the early pioneers and it really kind of set a model to work with and, against. Ann Stoller's book on rubber labor in Southeast Asia, of course, was another book that I was thinking a lot about, but she doesn't do as much with environment.
Yeah, that's much more focused on labor and empire and post-colonial.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Gender, things mm-hmm. like that she's known for.
Great, great book. That's her first book, and I think perhaps the least cited of all her works, but I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, in some ways the most specific, least theoretical, but also and riveting for me. But, you know, in Vietnamese studies, in kind of thinking about the environment is growing. And so what I wanted to do was build on the work of some folks who have come before, of course, David Biggs, Pierre Brochu in France, Philip Taylor in Australia, who have done things for the Mekong Delta, Pam McElwee, Frederic Thomas for forests. And then we also have some younger scholars, Hieu Phuong and Katie Diet, who are doing some really interesting stuff. But, you know, no one had done much with rubber. So I thought, look, this is a good field to look at. And then,
just to interject, Ben Kiernan's newer, a huge survey of Vietnamese history has quite a bit of environmental history in there. I was really impressed with that.
Yeah, that's right. I think he set out to include environmental history as a focus. And I think what, you know, this is where I think that the environmental historians in Vietnam are going to move towards. And I mean, there's a range of things they can do, but of course, writing the histories of animals or the histories of forests or water flows are, you know, is all ecosystems, very important.
The history of rats, what you do. You know?
The history of rats, absolutely. and plague, right? I mean, this is, you're
an informed reader. I'm shamelessly plugging my own book, but.
but your work, and I think, yes, you know, both the article and the recent book, I think actually moves more towards the environmental history that I studied at Wisconsin. And that's being done, I think, much more in American environmental history, which is incorporating environmental history into more established fields of study, right? So labor or the study, historical studies of race or colonialism, nationalism. I think those subfields need to take into account environment. And that's what I think that environmental history can really help to reframe our understandings of Vietnam and Vietnamese history in many different fields. So it's not, I don't want to be, think of environmental history in a very narrow way and kind of, you know, limit it to just what's considered non-human in Vietnam. I think it's more than that. And that's not, you know, that's more of a natural history, right? And people have done natural histories, but I think environmental history has an important role to play here.
Yeah, that's a really, really great point. And, you know, it should be one of the categories of analysis, like gender, like class, like race, that we work into our studies.
Yeah. Now, the question of ecological is the one that I was thinking about for a long time. And, you know, it's, as you know, it's very hard to come up with titles and subtitles for books. I don't know how you did it.
Your chapter titles are fabulous. Your chapter titles.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But it's very, you know, very stressful and go through many iterations. And, you know, Warren Dean, of course, as I mentioned, called his book an environmental history. But I ended up settling on ecological history for a couple of reasons. And the first is that I set out to write a history of interactions and processes. And the popular, I would say, understanding, even a very historical understanding of ecological as an adjective, is much more about the processes, right? Whereas environmental suggests perhaps something more static, like a landscape, like a, you know, something just around ambient kinds of factors. Now, that's not to say that environmental histories are static. They are very processual and they look at things. But I thought ecology would bring to the fore that relation, that emphasis. And there are also historical reasons for this. Now, one ecologist I cite in the book, a guy named Jean Adam, talked about colonial ecology and defined it as a study of connections. And this was in the 1930s. And so I think there's a reason, historical justification for that. Now, I have to say that, you know, I didn't set out to write a history of ecology as in a history of the science of ecology in Vietnam. And I think that would be a very interesting book. And I think one that needs to be written. But that would be a sort of much narrower definition. So when I'm talking about ecology or ecological history, I mean both the kind of popular, you know, general understanding of ecology is about connections, and then also what the science of ecology studies, which are these interconnections among, you know, humans and non-humans, or more recently humans, but especially among non-humans and ecosystems and processes. So that's why I chose ecological.
Okay, that's great. So that's why you chose ecological history. So why rubber? And what did you hope to achieve by using rubber as a way to explore 20th century Vietnamese history?
Yeah. So I guess there are both personal and academic reasons for this. Rubber, the personal side is that when I taught English in Vietnam, I spent the first year and a half in a place called Bien Hoa. And, you know, it's a growing city northeast of Saigon. In the 60s, it was a U.S. Air Force base, has some terrible Agent Orange dioxin related issues left from that time. But it also, during the colonial era, early the 20th century, was a center of rubber production. It was one of the first places that rubber expanded to after starting in Saigon. And so when I was living there in 1999 to 2001, of course, there were no rubber trees in the city anymore. Those are long gone. But if you take the bus to go from Bien Hoa to Dalat or up into the Central Highlands, you will pass through some rubber plantations still. And to me, that was fascinating. I mean, I'd never seen rubber. It was, you know, I'd grown up in Southern California, so I'd seen orange groves when I was growing up and things like that. But rubber was a new thing, and you know, just something that I was very interested in. But I kind of filed it away. Didn't know what I was going to do with it. And then when I came back to graduate school, and was tossing around for a topic, I was very influenced by some works on, thinking about labor and history of medicine and environmental history that had been coming out in the U.S. context. And it just struck me that rubber was one of these places where you had this agriculture plus, you know, human labor plus interactions with nature, and over a long time period, you know, the 20th century, and a very prominent also endeavor. So lots of archives, which as a historian is quite useful to have those. And, you know, the advantage of having been there, teaching English, I still knew some people and felt that it would be helpful to go back there.
Oh yeah, the personal connection is fantastic. Yeah, and so important in Vietnam.
Yeah, right. I mean, I feel so lucky because I, you know, some of the few people I was able to talk to who are still living from the colonial era, from the 1950s, who had worked on rubber plantations. I met them because, thanks to Vietnamese language teachers and friends from Bien Hoa, who, you know, I would have never been able to track down these people, but they knew these people. And then at the time when I started, also there really wasn't, you know, there's kind of the standard accounts of Martin Murray's book chapter from the 1980s, an article in the 1990s, and Chen Chubin's work on rubber. So, I just felt that story had become a little bit ossified, and people just talked about rubber and that was it. Then they moved on, right? And in the French literature, I think it was a little bit more lively. Christophe Bonneuil, who wrote a very brilliant chapter on rubber, and he wrote a dissertation on French agronomy, really incorporating Foucault into thinking about agriculture, and that was kind of an inspiration. But his work hadn't really had much effect on Vietnamese studies, at least in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, this book fills a great spot in the historiography. Just one quick question about the title and the framing of the time period. Why do you set the years of your study as 1897 to 1975?
Yeah, so I wanted to have a long time frame, at least as long as possible, to look at many different changes. And 1897 is just simply put when the first samples of rubber are sent to Vietnam, or let's say the first Hevia brasiliensis trees are shipped to Vietnam. At least, that's what's recorded. And Hevia brasiliensis is the species of tree from Brazil that gets transferred to or stolen from Brazil by a guy named Henry Wickham and then spread in the British Empire.
It was an act of espionage, correct?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it was heroic from the British point of view, but Joe Jackson has a nice book that shows, and others show basically how it's bio theft, and he knew it. He knew it at the time, right? so that rubber tree.
This is also occurring at the height or the depth of the horrors of the Belgian Congo in 1897, right? 1900. Yeah.
Yes.
All
yes.
At the same time.
Yes. Absolutely. And the horrors of the Belgian Congo, the peak of Amazonian rubber, wild rubber gathering and production, and the point when rubber in Southeast Asia is about to take off on plantations. So in the Dutch East Indies and British Malaya, especially. And then
1897 really is a global moment for the transfer of rubber production from wild collecting into plantations that take a few years to come online. But we have this global moment of change in regards to rubber, correct?
Absolutely. I would say maybe, the 1890s, right? And, and it takes a while for the rubber industry to take off in Vietnam and then later Cambodia, because French investors are actually more interested in just putting their money into British plantations and Dutch plantations at first. And so, it takes actually until the 1910s and 1920s for rubber in Vietnam to really take off. But the 1897 point marks also some of the early discussions of how to create the conditions for rubber, right? And already it's there's some interest in some idea that rubber might take off. And so, it's the example is being set by the British and the Dutch. So the French start to think about that. And then, of course, 1975 is the ending point of the Vietnam War, and a time when...
Also known as the American War in Vietnam.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The American War in Vietnam. The Americans are largely gone by then. There's a few hardy souls and people who are evacuating themselves right up at the end. But 1975 from the Vietnamese perspective is the year in which reunification, and whether you call it the liberation of Saigon or the fall of Saigon, happens. That's when socialist regime in the north, the communist regime, actually takes physical control of the plantations, right? And so in terms of plantations, that's a new chapter. And I think that there's actually a lot of work left to be done on the post-1975 to the present in terms of rubber plantations. But my book was already too long, and so I need to stop. 1975 was a moment in which there was a very big transition that, there wasn't room to cover.
And is there an archival issue around the date of 1975? I mean, my work is much earlier in the 20th century, And in the archives, I couldn't look at anything after 1954 working on Hanoi in northern Vietnam. So after 1975, are the archives less open?
Actually, interestingly, not. And this is where perhaps choosing a topic like rubber gave me an entree, in the sense that one of the things that I was really interested in doing was looking at the archives in Hanoi. Archives, well, number one, for the colonial era, which I know you have extensive experience in, and archives number three for the post-1946 era, which gather the Viet Minh and then the DRV records. And actually, I was told by someone working at the archives when I first showed up, and I told him my topic was rubber, and he's like, "Oh yeah, no, there's nothing on rubber in here. You know, this is archives number three. We don't have anything on rubber." Of course, turns out that there were things on rubber. The Hanoi Viet Minh and Hanoi was keenly interested in rubber for reasons that are in the book, and had some documentation that proved, you know, interesting. And that continued up until 1975. Actually, most of the documentation at archive number one in terms of rubber was from the First Indochina War. And then for the Vietnam War, the American War in Vietnam, a lot of that material was held in the archives in the South. So archive number two in Saigon, and the National Archives in the U.S., so the archives in College Park. And so that, you know, those records brought me up until 1975. Now, in fact, after 1975, there are records of the nationalized communist-controlled rubber companies sitting in archives number two that, as far as I know, have really not been looked at. And that would be, again, I think an interesting project just to go through. And I sampled some of those archives just to kind of get a sense of where plantations were, how they were functioning during, the economic embargo era, pre-Doi Mui, post-Doi Mui, pre, 1986, post-1986. But really just a smattering of, I looked at a smattering of records, and I think a kind of systematic study of those archives held national in two, Archive Center two, would be quite interesting.
Well, I hope there's some graduate students listening whose ears just perked up. They may have a dissertation project can follow in your footsteps here.
Trying to sell it.
Yeah. So do you see this book as fitting into the growing field of commodity history, such as Sven Beckert's Empire of Cotton or Kurlansky's Pop Histories of Salt and Cod, and so many other books on things like oil, spices, wood, and so forth? Or is this something other than commodity history?
Yeah, yes and no, I would say. I sent out, as I said, to write an environmental or ecological history of Vietnam. But the question at the beginning was what to specifically concentrate on. And rubber plantations seem to be a good way, a good topic, in part because they tapped into several existing conversations and bodies of literature, and could inject something new. So I saw that commodities literature as part of that, as one of the conversations where rubber had been talked about a lot, but also could be talked about in environmental terms. And I was actually a bit cautious about focusing on a commodity, partly because my training wasn't in commodity history. I wasn't set out to do that. That's not, what I was really thinking about. Some of the popular histories of commodities, I thought it kind of hit its peak, that salt and cod stuff, and didn't really do it for me. So, I was suspicious, I think, of commodities as an approach. But then also, right when I was starting grad school, I read Bill Cronin's classic Nature's Metropolis, and some of the, approaches in environmental history that have followed that use commodities as a jumping off point to talk about ecological processes. So I think there are types of commodity histories that can work very well environmentally. I think you can also do a commodity history that has nothing to do with the environment. And I was trying to do the commodities, the history that had a lot to do with the environment. Now, like I said, I also got lucky in the sense that commodities is one of these sort of recurring topics. And there was a postdoc fellowship at the Institute of Historical Studies at University of Texas, Austin, to work on the history of commodities. And so I really lucked out. This is while I was writing my book in 2014-15. And so I was able to work with the Institute's then director, was a historian of Brazil named Seth Garfield, who was working on a history of the Amazon that centered around rubber. And it was, during World War II. And he was doing a lot with environmental history. So he was very helpful to talk with. That was my approach. And I do have to say, though, too, fun in also in interesting ways, commodity like rubber, at least, especially, I think, wasn't very like, and probably won't be very hot as a topic. And so I was happy to do something where I wasn't necessarily stepping on other people's toes. And so it wasn't something that was kind of time sensitive in that sense.
Yeah.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, I mean, I think that one of the many achievements of the book is the way that it can appeal to a wide range of readers, those interested in Vietnamese history, environmental ecological history, labor history, commodity history. So it satisfies many different constituencies, so to speak. So I'm going to ask you to walk us through the book. You have it organized into three sections: Red Earth, Gray Earth, Forest without Birds, Rubber Wars, and these are of 1, 3, and 3 chapters respectively. And what's great is these chapters are both chronological but also thematic. But before we get through the actual book, let's spend a little bit of time in the plantations. And can you briefly tell us about the plantations? Where were they in Vietnam and Cambodia? Why were they situated on these sites? And what's the ideal terrain for a rubber plantation?
So the rubber plantations start in around 1897 on experimental stations. There's a couple fairly near Saigon, one in Nha Trang, where Alexander Yersin, one of the famous colonial medical doctors, has set up a Pasteur Institute. But the majority of rubber begins in the 1900s and 1910s on the gray earth, what we call gray earth soil or gray soils, surrounding Saigon and even part of Saigon. And if I remember correctly, there was even, I think it was a convent in Saigon that was using growing rubber to earn some cash to help themselves financially. So you could actually find rubber trees within the city limits in the early 20th century. And the same was true of Bienhoa. And now these ecologically, these soils are, these gray earth soils are composed mostly of river deposits from the Saigon River, from the Dong Nai River, and lots of sand, which gives them their gray character. So they drain well, fairly easily, but they don't have a lot of nutrients. And one of the problems with rubber trees is also that they often, especially when they're very young, blow down in storms. And so when a heavy winds would pass through, these grayer soils would not hold the trees down very efficiently. Now, they, of course, these early efforts, rubber planting on the gray earth, happened because the of the infrastructure that was needed to collect the latex, to process it. Once you have the sort of tappers draining the trees and collecting the latex, it has to be mixed with some various chemicals, including acetic acid to coagulate, and then have it dried out, and then shipped off. And almost all of the rubber produced in Saigon was just shipped to Singapore, where it was joined the market there and bought and sold by the world market. So Saigon offered the port and the facilities, and so did Bienhoa in the early years. Also, it happens that labor is more available at this time in those places, local labor, people, Vietnamese who are living there. And a lot of the early planters are people who are higher up in colonial society. So French engineers or retired engineers, retired government officials. One way to think of this is the image of the planter Mata in the film Indochine, which Catherine Deneuve plays a character, right, the plantation owner. And that's her character in the film is based on Madame de la Suchere, who is the wife of a planter owner who dies, of a planter who dies, and then she takes over the plantation. So that's a kind of like the model of the early 1910s plantation. But as those lands are taken and the rubber boom of the 1920s takes off, you have a lot of multinational companies start to move in. So you have the French and the Belgians coming in, and they are looking for large tracts of land. And this is where the governing and economic logic come together to push plantations out onto what are largely red earth soils or red soils in near the foothills of the Central Highlands, out into what's now Tay Ninh or Binh Duong province, Dam Nai province, Binh Phuc, sort of that what's called Dam Nam Bo, or southern southeast region, and this these plantations kind of they fulfill a dual function. They both help the colonial government explore and what the colonial government wanted to do with the ethnic peoples living there, the so-called Montagnards in the region, including people called the Steng and the Fom, but also there were some ethnic Chinese out in the area. So the colonial officials, they're always on a shoestring budget. And so the plantations kind of promised to give some financial incentive, a way to extend government into these areas. And also, to develop, or what's called at the time, mise en valeur for the region, to bring this to the region. And of course, the plantations are interested in earning profits and fairly, cheap land in almost, given away, but very, very cheap, sold very, very cheaply. Now, the big losers in this process, as plantations move out and away from Saigon and Bienhoa, that area, to the Red Earth, are both the groups living in the region, as you can imagine, and also the laborers on these new plantations. And so the groups living in the region suffer from, you know, what we call today land grabbing, essentially. So the, you know, the government, colonial government, sometimes professes, you know, to want to protect these groups, and they say, look, we want to protect their land. But most of the time, they're just either not willing to or not able to protect. They weren't able to do that. And so these groups were all, you know, largely at the mercy of plantations. Another reason why these groups were kind of easily targeted is that their agricultural system was largely based on Swidden agriculture. And, you know, Swidden agriculture is this process of cutting down trees, burning them, and then planting things on that burned plots, and then moving every couple of years through cycles, basically, that travel through the forest.
In sharp contrast to wet rice agriculture, which is settled and the same rice paddies are worked for generations, if not centuries, correct?
Yes, absolutely, right. And you know, because of that contrast, the law is actually not set up. Land ownership is not set up to recognize in the same ways the Swidden agricultural ownership of land and rice agriculture. Now, of course, rice agriculture, as Brochure and others have shown, is that you know, those lands can be easily stolen as well. But with Swidden agriculture, you have, you know, low population densities. You have also this idea that Swidden is ecologically disastrous. And so you see foresters, Frederick Thomas has shown how foresters at the time argued that Swidden lost, you know, what would cost the colonial state wood and resulted in erosion. And so the colonial government was pressured by that argument. Of course, it's ironic because the very same practices that, you know, foresters were complaining about in terms of Swidden were used to create plantations themselves, right? How would the plantation be created? Well, they would cut down the forest, burn it, and then plant rubber trees, right? You know, the only difference might be in terms of erosion. But, you know, and often the same people are doing that cutting and burning. So, but you have this, you know, forester idea that the Swidden is bad, and the planters are arguing that there's nobody on these lands, even though they know that's not true. And so the people who are living there, essentially most of the time lose out their lands to these plantations. Now,
into chapter one, which is Civilizing Latex. That's the title, chapter one, Civilizing Latex. So what does this chapter tell us about plantation agriculture and French visions of modernity? You've been touching on this, but if you could just really lay this out, how did the French see their plantations?
Yeah, I want to get with the idea of civilizing and really bring that up in terms of latex, because again, of this dual use of plantations to both extend government and infrastructure into this region of Vietnam that had been largely, you know, left alone by the colonial state until the early 20th century. This sort of economic project, right? So in the first chapter, I'm arguing that the plantations both benefit from interest in this region and attempts to create infrastructure, new roads into the region. You have rivers, and those are useful for the early transport, but you still need road networks. And on the reverse side, the plantations are helping to extend governance into these regions. And so, by setting up, what often happens is that these plantations become states within states, and sometimes colonial officials complain about this, that, you know, they interfere actually with road building and other colonial laws, because they're so so much like fortresses. But this initial movement into the Red Earth region is really driven by both ideology, right, mise en valeur, civilizing mission, and the practicalities of latex and the economics of making a profit. So that's where I'm going with the first chapter, and showing the kind of the transition from what you can say as a pre-plantation landscape to a post-plantation landscape.
Yeah, which feeds right into the next question about I have for you about the title of the second section. It's this interesting title, Forest Without Birds. Where does this term come from, and why did you pick it, and what does it mean?
So the term actually comes from the exact term Forest Without Birds comes from Justin Godart, who is a former French minister of health. And he visits plantations. He visited plantations in the 1930s in French Indochina as part of his fact-finding mission for the Commission Garneau. And so he, you know, and this is something his notes have been published in French. And this is a poetic description that he comes up for the plantations. Cause he's, you know, he's somewhat worried by the nature on these plantations. He can't quite put a hand, finger on it, but, he's, you know, unsettled by, what's going on here. And the problem, I thought that was a very nice description for plantations, forests without birds. It also, you know, refers to sort of, ways that plantations now are often, planters try to, count them, companies try to count them as forests for carbon emission purposes. But, you know, they, of course, they're plantations, so it's nothing to do with each other. But a lot of people said that title was way too abstract for the book, and that people would expect more birds in the book. So, and of course, there are not too many birds in the book.
You toyed with that as a book title. That's great.
Yeah, I
love the term because it, you know, it prefigures Rachel Carson, so it has this link to, you know, people more familiar with American environmental history, and I found it such a so fascinating. In chapter two, which is the first chapter in this section, it's titled "Cultivating Science." What are you talking about here when you speak of cultivating science?
So. The agricultural sciences, things like, well, at the time called agronomy, and were really established in French Indochina about the same time that rubber plantations are being created. So you have to start to have schools, experimental stations. And so I argue in that chapter that the colonial economy, colonial agronomy, and colonial plantations are inextricably linked at that time and through that process. And I use the term rubber science to refer to those two. And this rubber science then structures the understandings of rubber. It encourages large foreign plantations to come in and, you know, grow rubber. Most of the science that's being produced is useful for large monocultures rather than smallholders. So there's not much, really no outreach in the early 20th century to try to promote, Vietnamese smallholders of rubber, a process that happens in the Dutch East Indies and British Malaya to a much larger degree. And so that capture in some sense of the two, the colonial agriculture and colonial plantations, is not broken until anti-colonial and independence movements, right? And so that's really, that forms the basis of that. I also put this chapter here because this is the, you know, the kind of next step in forming a plantation, right? So you have the kind of the initial conditions in chapter one, and then what do you have to do next? Or what do the rubber planters do next? They gradually accept the necessity of agricultural science in their endeavors.
And then in chapter three, we see another issue that science has to attend to and medicine has to attend to, and that's the impact of various diseases, especially malaria. So can you say a few words on the history of disease and what did the French planters and the, more importantly, the Vietnamese laborers face on the plantation in terms of disease?
Yeah. So the as you know, history of medicine is a quite a important topic in colonial history. And in terms of the plantations, this is really the, you know, the kind of, as plantations move out to the Red Earth region, malaria becomes a huge problem. And, it's a disaster in the 1920s. And this happens for a few reasons. So first of all, these areas in the Red Earth region, which are farther from the urban centers of Saigon and Bien Hoa, are generally, you know, have more either primary or secondary growth forest. So they have to be cleared to create a plantation. And while some of this clearing work is done by montagnards who are, you know, more accustomed to this kind of work, a lot of it is done by Vietnamese laborers. And as the plantations get established in the Red Earth region, they have almost an insatiable demand for labor, right? More than can be provided through the South alone. And so the planters try many different solutions to try to import laborers. Some they even try to import them from Java, from the Dutch East Indies, from other places in Southeast Asia. But what the planters finally settle on is encouraging migration from northern Vietnam and north central Vietnam. And these migrants, you know, another kind of advantage for the planters of creating these large plantations out in the middle of nowhere is that they can largely charge whatever they can largely pay whatever they want for labor, only, you know, minimally regulated by the state. They also, laborers have very little recourse. It's very hard to leave these plantations in the middle of nowhere, far from relations that the laborers have. And the natural, I would say, the non-human nature part of this equation is that these red earth soils are very ecologically very different from the gray earth soils. So these red earth soils are made from decaying volcanic deposits, and so they contain a lot of clay, which means that they are more nutrient rich, but they also don't drain very well. And so when I explain this in the book, but when the forests are cut down, you have large standing puddles of water. Of course, it's raining, you know, a lot in this region. Large puddles of water. Perfect breeding spaces for particular species of mosquitoes, and actually the timing makes a difference in when you go from deforestation to unforested land to reforested or replantation land, and along with the background occurrence of Plasmodia falciparum in the populations, local populations, the ethnic minorities, all of these come together, and you have what are called at the time epidemics of malaria. And especially in late 1920s, some months you have up to 50% of the plantation workforce die from diseases. And it's not just malaria. Obviously, this is because they're weak, they're underfed, they're overworked. And you know, the housing is shoddy and terrible, but the thing that finally kills them is often malaria. And so we, I think as historians talk a lot about what David Del Testis wrote to me in an email once, the lick of the whip as being the most important thing in the plantations. And It's very picturesque, but actually the malaria that occurs in the 1920s is more
the real,
deadly.
The real killer.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Enabled by the plantations, of course.
Right.
But
right.
The real killer.
Colonial modernization projects creating unintended health crises.
Where do we see that?
another great book topic. Okay, chapter 4 is called Turning Tropical, and it considers the transformation of colonial science. You've touched on this previously, but could you just say a few words on that and what your argument is in this chapter?
So, you know, if you're looking at the book as kind of layer upon a layer of history, right, the past, this is the chapter in which I look at a layer that marks the shift in some ways from colonial science to what's more often called tropical science. And this occurs in both medicine and agriculture, which I examine, but, you know, to geography, right, to tropical geography. Pierre Guerou is part of the shift. You can see it in ecology, tropical ecology. And in this chapter, I trace out I argue that older racial categories that were so prominent in the colonial sciences are imported into the tropical sciences. And although the tropical sciences speak more about the environment, they speak more about populations and things that I would say are less overtly racial in their conception, they are still informed by colonial practices. Obviously, during the 1930s, these are still very much colonial sciences, and that, you know, that carries on in that tradition. So I'm looking at the ways in which, in some ways, tropical medicine and agriculture are responding to emerging out of efforts to respond to plantations as phenomenon, right?
The final section has three chapters, the first of which is entitled Maintaining Modernity. And this chapter talks about the role of the plantations in the First Indochina War, the Vietnamese struggle for independence from the French. What can you tell us about the role of plantations in this war?
So the role of plantations is, and what I argue in this chapter is that they have become landscapes that start to shape political and military, in the sense, activity, and they are have been established, and really you see the implications of what it means to have plantation agriculture in Vietnam, and that's both true symbolically and materially. So symbolically, the plantations are, again, still viewed by the French as being super modern. Paul Moose talks about this in his book, Sociology of a War. And the French can point to hospitals and this kind of infrastructural modernity that colonialism is supposed to bring to French Indochina, to Vietnam. But the argument that the Viet Minh are making is that these plantations are symbolic of colonial horrors. And this includes labor abuse. This includes the taking of colonial resources, the taking of resources, even if they're either natural or created resources, out of Vietnam, and enriching the metropole. And so there's a big struggle there in terms of that symbolic understanding of plantations. Now, this actually bleeds into military strategy during the First Indochina War from the documents I was looking at in the archives, number 3, where initially in 1946, 47, 48, the Viet Minh leaders adopt a scorched earth policy. And Pierre Brochet has argued about this for other places in Vietnam. And the idea is to burn it down, right? And it's kind of an anarchist approach to colonialism. Just get rid of everything and start anew, wash it away in blood, right? And this works for a while, but you know, as the war goes on, and especially in the South and the plantations there, the Viet Minh are not doing super well. So there's that aspect of it. But then also in around the 1950s, at least for plantations. Now, this may be true of other economic infrastructure, other economic projects or not, but at least for plantations, you see a shift in the rhetoric. And the Viet Minh start to talk about the need to preserve this economic infrastructure because it will become national, right? And whether that's for, you know, a growing sense of perhaps optimism that the French will eventually leave, you know, the victory of the PRC, the People's Republic of China in 1949, and, you know, sort of the growing resources that the Viet Minh have. There's this idea, though, that starts to, at least among the leadership, circulate that you can take the plantations for hostage, you can, you know, take rice, you can take medical equipment, you can even take latex and sell it on the black market, or you can burn latex, but don't necessarily destroy the trees, because those will be what is left over. And that's, you know, when the Viet Minh take control of the country, they'll need to have some kind of economic you know, infrastructure to rebuild and to run the country. Now, this is not necessarily making it, these ideas are not necessarily making their way down to the ground level and the cadre on the you know, in the plantation. So you do still see, obviously, sabotage and all kinds of activities taking on, but the idea is to push towards more of a kind of drawing from the resources of the plantations without completely, and making the French want to leave without completely destroying them. The other way that plantations are shaping the First Indochina War is you already start to have the Viet Minh realizing that they are actually a very useful fighting space. And so French planters are encouraged by the French military to, you know, build towers and control the plantation space. And they're told by the French military that they have to pay for all of that. But that is not a super effective way to run a plantation. And these, you know, because plantations are so big, because they were encouraged to be so big during the colonial era, they're actually really hard to control, especially along the fringes. So, you know, if you've ever been on a plantation, you can't see, you know, you don't have unfettered horizontal sight. You don't have, you can't see from above if the leaves are there. So it's hard to survey from plains. And so this, the, you know, fighting is different than it is during the Vietnam War, but still the plantations can and start to begin to serve as these, you know, places of refuge and places where the Viet Minh can start to take advantage of the plantation space.
So this takes us into chapter 6, which is decolonizing plantations. And this is the fate of the plantations once the war was over. So Vietnam is no longer under French rule. What happens to these former French plantations? Or should I say, do they become former French plantations in post-colonial Vietnam and South Vietnam?
No, largely no. There are, of course, some Vietnamese who get into ownership of plantations after the First Indochina War. There's, especially under Ngo Dinh Diem after 1954, there's a rhetoric of national development. There's a rhetoric of Vietnamese owning economic you know, infrastructure in South Vietnam, in the Republic of South Vietnam. But by and large, the plantations remain, especially the large plantations, remain in French hands. So things like Michelin, there are other plantation groups that continue. Now, this is a problem in some ways for Ngo Dinh Diem. He's very much caught between the nationalist rhetoric that he's running and you know, very much believes and acts on in a number of ways, and the need to maintain some kind of economic earnings for the Republic of Vietnam, especially as the National Liberation Front in the 1960s, early 1960s, starts to ramp up its activity, rice production starts to decline quite precipitously. And so rubber becomes, in the 1960s, the number one earner. And in this way, the French, especially the large plantations, are somewhat indispensable, right? Too big to fail under Ngo Dinh Diem. And he can't really, even though he's running the head of the government, he's limited in terms of the options he has. And he always is reassuring the plantations that he's not going to nationalize them. Now, this dynamic interacts with the arrival of the Americans and this new, you know, Cold War ideology of development, which a lot of historians have looked at in terms of South Vietnam and the importance of development ideology. Now, most of those historians have focused on rice growing places, the Mekong Delta, the strategic hamlets. Only really Stan Tan has looked at the Central Highlands as a site of development ideology. And so the rubber plantations are, of course, swept up into this ideology. Now, what this chapter shows is that older influences of mise en valeur, development, civilizing mission, actually reform and continue to adjust the development project and kind of influence its execution in the 1960s, right? So the pressures on Ngo Dinh Diem, these older ideologies that have formed certain relationships, ecological relationships in the land, make it difficult to run development in the way that development planners wanted to. So they, you know, development Americans especially come in and say, look, you got to make a lot of smallholders here, you know, 40 acres and a mule kind of ideology, right? And in terms of farming in South Vietnam, and that doesn't work for plantations. They are hard to change once they're in that kind of mode.
Right, right. So it's so fascinating that this period of the late 1950s is this golden age of the plantations, because there's disaster on the horizon. And in your last full chapter, Militarizing Rubber, you talk about the impact of the steadily ramped up violence of the American military in the Second Indochina War. So what's the fate of the rubber plantations during the American War from 1964, 1965 to January 1973?
Largely destruction. They are become, you know, the sites of fierce battles. And even more than the First Indochina War, during the Vietnam War, plantations are key strategic sites. So and the reason for this is that they sit at the end of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, right? So you have the Ho Chi Minh Trail going through Laos, coming through Cambodia, and basically emptying out into South Vietnam. You know, it's a number of paths, obviously. It's not just one like unified trail, but largely emptying out, like, you know, a river in a delta through the plantations. And so the headquarters of the resistance the headquarters that's the COSBIN that's joining the National Liberation Front and the North Vietnamese commanding leadership is based in and around the rubber plantation region. Part of that is, again, because of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the sighting of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Another part of that is because they have the border there. So you have this Cambodia-Vietnam border, which Cambodia is technically neutral. And so the communists use that neutrality. And of course, you know, they're breaking the neutrality. U.S. is breaking the neutrality. The Republic of Vietnamese forces are breaking. Everyone's breaking neutrality. But there's the border there that the communists can slip back and forth on. And you know, it's joined by these plantations. And so what the Americans, and you see this in the archives from National Archives in College Park, are really intent in taking out this plantation landscape from use, from Vietnamese use. And so they sometimes spray it with herbicides, commonly known as Agent Orange. And of course, the French companies like Michelin sue the U.S. government for doing that. They claim military right of way, and they plow under rubber trees on the sides of roads, including on Vietnamese plantations. And Vietnamese try to get money for this, but the U.S. military is protected by international law for not having to pay much for these war-related damages. And so largely it's an assault on the plantation landscape. And, you know, in terms of labor, you have the daily violence of the Vietnam War, where really many rubber workers talk about being caught between the communist at night and the Republic of Vietnam government during the day. And so rubber workers are, you know, there are many who are active in the communist movement, but there are many who just are either neutral or, don't want to get involved. And so their lives become extremely difficult. And as plantation after plantation starts to shut down because of violence into the 1970s, rubber workers have very little options in terms of how they're going to earn a living. And so you have this, growing number of unemployed workers who have to find their livelihood.
Yeah. And the Communist Party has a somewhat complicated relationship with the rubber workers' unions, correct?
Yes, they do. There is a, the Communist Party really likes to point towards its management and its support from the rubber workers. And there are times when the rubber workers find it advantageous to emphasize this mixing of communism and rubber worker activity. But there's definitely rubber worker activism and labor strikes that exist outside the framework of the communist rubber unions. And so you can see, some of the different, many, many different unions organized at this time. And some of the rubber worker unions are organized by Chung Quoc Bu and, the Catholic workers and the more general South Vietnamese unions. Some are organized by the communist-led unions. But it's by no means are all the rubber workers organized under the communist-driven, communist-controlled unions, labor unions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, which leads me to my final question on the book, and by way of conclusion, you discuss rubber in post-war Vietnam. So how did a united Vietnam under Communist Party rule deal with plantation agriculture as a system of production, especially considering that the party spent so much time vilifying the plantations and condemning the plantations as the worst excesses of the colonial system? So how does the party now run plantations, and how important is rubber in the contemporary Vietnamese economy?
Well, part of this answer will come from the graduate student who looks at the archives for post-1975 rubber. I think the details are still, largely to be sketched out and many, many interesting insights. But in general, you see, even in the 60s, this growing attempt to appropriate the rubber plantations as both national space, but as communist space, particularly in terms of the North Vietnamese government. And so, for example, you see money being put out where rubber workers are working in a mechanized plantation landscape. You see posters, being produced that call, rubber and sort of show how rubber can support a communist socialist government. And so you have that growing appropriation, symbolic appropriation, but then you have the real reality after 1975 that the plantations are in ruins, right? You have your labor force is dispersed. the plantations have been heavily damaged by the war. You've lost most of your expertise in terms of rubber growing. There are a few experts like Dan Van Vin and some, you know, planter, rubber manager, Vietnamese rubber specialist who stay in Vietnam after 1975, but many of them leave. And so rebuilding the infrastructure and the labor force is very hard for the communist government. And not until the 1990s and especially in the 2000s does rubber really become a force? And then it becomes again quite important in Vietnam. So obviously by the 2000s, Vietnam has a much different economy than it did in the 1960s and 70s and 80s. And rubber is not the leading export in South Vietnam. Rice is once again that. But rubber generates, I think it's like $2 to $3 billion a year at some points in the mid 2000s in earnings, and especially from selling to China. So this is, you know, when China's economy is really taking off, they're buying all the rubber they can and using it for all kinds of things. You know, now a lot of natural rubber is used for very high quality things, medical gloves, airplane tires, things that are involve much better quality of rubber. And a lot of the low quality uses of rubber, things like motorbike tires and those kinds of things, are actually synthetic rubber fulfills most of that demand.
Are they importing the synthetic rubber?
What's that?
Are they importing synthetic rubber?
You mean Vietnamese?
Yeah, is it synthetic imported into Vietnam, or are they also producing synthetic rubber?
No, so most of the rubber being produced in Vietnam is natural, and most of the kind of processing of rubber is still taking place outside of Vietnam. So there are some tire manufacturing plants that are springing up in Vietnam, which I haven't looked into this quite a lot, but that may be using some imported synthetic rubber. But most of the
Vietnam plantations are still producing the cash crop, the commodity, and then the value added work is being done elsewhere.
Still to a large degree, right? Now, the similarity, another similarity with the colonial era is that plantations also are becoming, rubber plantations in particular, are becoming these ways in which the Vietnamese government is able to expand influence into Laos and Cambodia. And so many of the same issues that arose when French and Belgian plantations were expanding into the Red Earth region are recurring in Laos and Cambodia these days. So land grab and people being kicked off their land. It's unfortunately, you have an echo of that going on.
Yeah. One of the things that I saw this year, I lived in Cambodia for 5 months in Siem Reap. And one of the phenomenon is that there's a dramatic increase in tourists from the People's Republic of China. And one of the things that's pitched to them is buying natural latex mattresses. And there's this whole industry of marketing locally produced mattresses to Chinese tourists.
Yeah, wow.
So we've taken up a lot of your time. I really appreciate that. It's been a fascinating conversation. But before we let you go, we've got one more question. And now that this first book is done, what are you working on? So what can we hope to see from you in the near future?
So I am building on some of the work in the first book and taking it in a slightly different direction. I'm looking at, for a second book project, Vietnamese efforts to resist environmental warfare during the Cold War. And so I, Jacob Hamlin has a book called Arming Mother Nature, which is a few years old now, but he talks about environmental warfare and its occurrence. He references Vietnam was one of his chapters. And so I'm thinking that I will call it Disarming Mother Nature, but this is a provisional title right now. But the point of the book would be, and this is how I have it in my mind right now, is that You know, there's been work done on herbicides and in Agent Orange and environmental warfare in Vietnam, but little X has been done to explore, at least in English, the history to resist efforts, to resist environmental warfare. And so one of my arguments is that these efforts to resist environmental warfare from, you know, looking at some archival material from the 1950s, is that it's drawing on older ideas of coping with natural disasters and how you cope with typhoons or floods. And so, you know, in order to cope with these, potential of biological warfare that the Americans or the French might use, or climate warfare that was used during the Vietnam War, or herbicides, you can look to, both, kind of contemporary ideas about hygiene and things, and but also older ideas about how to think about natural disaster or relief efforts. And then on the other hand, this resistance to environmental warfare would, and I, you know, have to expand on this, but it also helps contribute to some early environmental consciousness in Vietnamese society, such as it is. So one of the first moments when people in Vietnam become aware that, nature can be problematic in a modern sense, I guess, pollution, chemicals and things like that, is during, sadly, the Cold War, when Vietnamese society is largely the target of environmental warfare activities.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I can't wait to see that. Get to work so that we can get you back on the podcast and talk about that book.
Thanks, Mike. I would appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Mitch. This was really, really a fascinating conversation about just a great book.
Yeah, thank you. I had a lot of fun.
Yep, this has been a conversation with Professor Michitake Esso of State University New York, Albany, about his new book, Rubber and the Making of Vietnam, An Ecological History, 1897 to 1975. I'm Michael Vann of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you so much for listening.